If you have your Bibles, you can turn to John chapter 5. John chapter 5, 1 through 18 is where the lesson's coming from this morning. Jason is preaching in the second half of the year, more or less chronologically through the Gospels again. So we're looking at John chapter 5 this morning. Next week, he'll look at the second half of John chapter 5. So John chapter 5, verses 1 through 18. While you were turning there, when I was a kid, my mom took it upon herself, bless her, to teach me how to read. And we had these little readers, and they were called the Matt Sat books. The whole point of the book was that this guy named Matt, a cartoon character, was going to sit on some three-letter word, because obviously that's what I could pronounce at 4 years old. So one day my mom is trying to teach me how to read with these books. And I tried, and I tried to get it right. So after excruciating effort for about 3 hours, my mom would probably tell you 10 minutes if you ask her. I'm pretty sure it was 3 hours. After that much effort, I eventually told her something. You know what I told her? I said, "It's too hard. I can't do it. It's too hard, and I can't do it." So what was I doing there? What was I saying to her? Well, what I was saying is that, "Mom, you're expecting something of me that I can't do." That's what I was saying. See, I was resting in my inability, or what I thought was my inability, to do something. Now, of course, this isn't remotely true because 3 weeks later I was reading it just fine. So it wasn't remotely true that I couldn't do it. And yet, I still made that excuse. That's still exactly what I said. Now, here's the weird thing. People do the exact same thing with God today. They make excuses, and they rest in their inability, and they tell him they can't do something. And so that brings us to the passage this morning, John chapter 5, verses 1 through 18. Let's read that. "After this, there was a feast of the Jews, and Jesus went up to Jerusalem. Now there is in Jerusalem by the sheep gate a pool, which is called in Hebrew Bethesda, having 5 porches. In these lay a great multitude of sick people, blind, lame, paralyzed, waiting for the moving of the water. For an angel went down at a certain time into the pool and stirred up the water. Then whoever stepped in first after the stirring of the water was made well of whatever disease he had. Now a certain man was there who had an infirmity 38 years. When Jesus saw him lying there and knew that he already had been in that condition a long time, he said to him, 'Do you want to be made well?' The sick man answered him, 'Sir, I have no man to put me into the pool when the water is stirred. But while I am coming, another steps down before me.' Verse 8, Jesus said to him, 'Rise, take up your bed and walk.' And immediately the man was made well, took up his bed and walked. And that day was the Sabbath. The Jews therefore said to him who was cured, 'It is the Sabbath. It is not lawful for you to carry your bed.' He answered them, 'He who made me well said to me, take up your bed and walk.' Then they asked him, 'Who is this man who said to you, take up your bed and walk?' But the one who was healed did not know who it was, for Jesus had withdrawn, a multitude being in that place. Afterward, Jesus found him in the temple and said to him, 'See, you have been made well. Sin no more, lest a worse thing come upon you.' Verse 15. The man departed and told the Jews that it was Jesus who had made him well. For this reason, the Jews persecuted Jesus and sought to kill him, because he had done these things on the Sabbath. But Jesus answered them, 'My Father has been working until now, and I have been working.' Therefore the Jews sought to kill him all the more, because he not only broke the Sabbath, but also said that God was his Father, making himself equal to God." This is God's word. So the question that I want to look at this morning is pretty simple. Where do you find rest? Where do you find your peace? Where do you find comfort? And there's two answers, really three answers, that are given in the text we just looked at. One, you can rest in your inability. Two, you can rest in your ability. Or three, you can rest in Jesus. Those are the three options you have. So let's take those in order. One, some people rest in their inability. Now, this concept may seem a little strange, because you probably can think of some people who rest in their ability. I mean, the Pharisees are a great example of this. They had peace because they could keep the law well. They thought their perfect law-keeping was going to save them. So the Pharisees are people who rest in their ability. Okay, so this is pretty simple for us, right? What about the people who rest in inability? How does that even work? Well, I think the passage answers that for us. If you look in verse 6, Jesus asks a question. Do you want to be made well? Now, on the surface, this kind of looks like a pointless question, right? I mean, he's been sitting there for 40 years. Of course he wants to be made well. Can we stipulate? Can we stipulate that Jesus, as the master teacher, doesn't waste words? Can we agree that Jesus isn't going to ask a pointless question? You think that's a reasonable assumption? So you would think the answer is obviously yes, but look what he says. It's not actually yes. If you look in verse 7, what he says is, I have no one to put me in the pool, and someone else always jumps in ahead of me. That's what his answer was. So, here's the idea I'd like to put before you. Maybe Jesus knew what this man's answer was going to be. Maybe Jesus knew that this man had given up hope. Maybe Jesus even knew, maybe this man didn't want to be healed. Maybe he was so blinded by his struggles that he had just given up. Maybe that's what Jesus knew here. Because he seems, when Jesus offers him the opportunity to be healed, he's not jumping up and saying yes. That's not what he's doing. Now, there's a question. I kind of wonder, was he even trying? He had been there for 38 years. Was he even trying at this point? I think it's fair to say the lame man at this point is resting in his inability. So what does that do to you? Well, three things, really. One, it distracts you from your real problem. How do you know the lame man was distracted? Was the lame man distracted from his real problem? I think absolutely yes. How do I know he was distracted? Because Jesus came back to him. And what did Jesus say when he came back to the lame man? What he told him was, stop sinning so that something worse doesn't happen to you. Now notice this conversation doesn't happen the first time. This conversation doesn't happen when the lame man is healed the first time. Instead, apparently the lame man doesn't say that much. Jesus slips off into the crowd. I think it's fair to say the lame man was distracted from his real problem. And his real problem was not that he couldn't walk. His real problem, like my real problem, like your real problem, is your sin. And here's the thing, it's unbelievably empowering when you realize that the worst thing that can happen to you is not your circumstances. It's not what other people do to you. It's not the physical condition that you have. That's not the worst thing that can happen to you. The worst thing that can happen to you is the sin that you bring on yourself. So this is an empowering message that your circumstances don't define your destiny. They don't define who you are or how you live. That's the message that you see here in John chapter 5. I mean, I think this is why Paul says in Philippians chapter 4, I can do all things through Christ who strengthens me. Now, a lot of people will sometimes whip out this verse when there's something that they want. If there's some kind of wealth or some kind of career accomplishment or a house they want, they say, I can do all things through Jesus who strengthens me. Athletes love to cite this verse. Here's the thing. The verse is actually saying the exact opposite. If you look in verse 12, right before Philippians 4:13, what it actually says is, I know how to be abased, and I know how to abound. Everywhere and in all things I have learned both to be full and to be hungry, both to abound and to suffer need. So what Paul's teaching there is not that Jesus is going to help you score a touchdown. He's actually saying the exact opposite. If you don't score a touchdown, Christ is still sufficient for you. If you don't get exactly what you want in this life, Christ is still sufficient for you. You can still have joy, and you can still have peace, because I can do all things through Christ who strengthens me. So your real problem is not anything around you. So don't be distracted like the lame man was. And Jesus confirms this himself with his own actions. If you look in John chapter 5, if you look in verse 13, there were tons of people around. This attracted a crowd of people around him. Now, if Jesus' purpose is to start a healing ministry, he missed a huge opportunity here. That's not what he did. When all the crowd is clamoring for more, when he has them in the palm of his hands, he doesn't ramp up the healing, he walks away. Now, this should show you, our real problem is not physical infirmity. I imagine there were dozens, maybe hundreds of people who were still at that pool who Jesus did not heal. The lame man was the only one who got healed that day, as far as we know. So this should show us there's something greater, something more important even than physical infirmity. Don't be distracted from the real problem. So that's one problem the lame man had. What's another problem that the lame man had? Well, two, it produces an all-consuming self-reliance. That's what resting in your inability will do. Well, what do I mean by this? Well, think about Jesus' question here. When the lame man says, well, I'm trying to get in, but other people jump ahead of me, Jesus doesn't respond to that by saying, well, you just need to try harder. That's not what he says. He's not saying you need to make more friends who can carry you in. He's not saying your effort is insufficient for me. That's not at all what Jesus says. His first question is a very simple one. Do you want to be made well? What's that question about? It's a question about the heart, right? It's asking, what do you want? Where is your heart? Where are your desires? Because that's what matters. I mean, think about it this way. A lot of times around New Year's, people will make New Year's resolutions. And then, about a month later, you never hear anything about them again until 11 months later. Why does that happen? It's because a lot of resolutions are rooted in just sheer willpower. They're not rooted in a change of the heart. And what Jesus invites the lame man to do here is not to have greater sheer willpower. What he invites him here to do is to have a change of the heart and to open his heart to Jesus. Now, here's the weird thing. We think about people in the world as being self-reliant to the nth degree. We think about people outside churches as being all-consumingly self-reliant. And here's a strange thing. This mindset, in a lot of ways, has creeped into mainstream Christianity. When I was a student in Auburn, one of my favorite things to do was just go to the bookstore and look around at the new titles they had in stock. I'm actually a pretty boring guy. My ideal Friday night is to go home and read a history book for an hour, then go to bed at 9 p.m. Back on topic. I was at a bookstore in Auburn, and I was looking through the Christian section. I don't go there that much, but had some free time that day. And I was looking through just the titles of the books that were on the shelves, and there was a theme that started to jump out at me. And I wrote down just 8 of the titles that I saw on the shelves there. So I'll read you off the titles that I saw this day. And as you listen, see if you can pick out a theme to these books. Okay, 1. It's Your Time. Activate your faith, achieve your dreams, and increase God's favor. 2. Think better, live better. A victorious life begins in your mind. 3. Get your hopes up. Expect something great to happen to you every day. 4. Your best life now. 7 steps to living at your full potential. 5. You can, you will. 8 undeniable qualities of a winner. 6. Do yourself a favor. Forgive. Learn how to take control of your life through forgiveness. 7. Reposition yourself, living life without limits. Last one, talk yourself happy. Transform your heart by speaking God's promises. Okay, if you were paying attention, in every single one of those titles was the word you, or a derivative of it, like your. That was in every single one of those. See, this is not the psychology section. This is not the self-help section. Not that there's anything wrong with that. This is the Christian section of the bookstore, though. And these are the kinds of bestsellers that people are looking to. So if you want to know about all-consuming self-reliance, you don't just look outside the church. You can look in mainstream Christianity and see the exact same thing. And it's not the gospel. Because Jesus makes a beautiful promise to us. And you know what it is? It's the exact same promise that he made to the lame man. Do you want to be made well? See, that's all he asks. He doesn't ask, can you afford to be made well? He doesn't ask, can you make yourself well? He doesn't ask, do you deserve to be made well? No, all he asks is, do you want to be made well? Because here's the thing. The only thing that Jesus asks, the only thing that he's ever asked, is that you say, Lord, I believe, help my unbelief. That's the only thing he's ever asked of us. So don't rely on yourself. Don't be like the lame man. Instead, lean on Jesus and find your rest in him. That's the promise he gives us. That's the hope that he gives to you. 3, what's another problem with resting in your inability? It's pride. Now, this may seem a little counterintuitive. It's prideful to rest in your own inability. Because if you're wallowing in your own sin, and if you're wallowing in your own imperfections, you're actually not being humble. Now, the lame man is essentially saying, I'm so weak, there's no way I could be healed. And people today say similar things like, I'm so bad that God can never save me. Have you ever heard someone say something like that? I've done so many bad things that there's no way that God could come and save me. Now, many people mistake this for humility. People say, well, they think so little of themselves. They must be so humble to have that view of themselves. It's actually just the opposite. It's not humility. The problem is actually pride. Because Jesus says in Matthew 17, if you have the faith of a mustard seed, you can move mountains. So resting in your inability is an assault on the character of God. Because what you're saying is, God is not big enough to change me. And God is not powerful enough to save me. And God is not good enough to give me a new heart. What you're actually saying is, all my past and all my problems are bigger than my God. In other words, I am bigger than my God. See, that's where the pride comes in. It's actually not humility at all. The problem is not that you need a self-confidence boost and you just don't believe in yourself enough. The problem is that you disbelieve in God and you don't put enough faith in his promises. In verse 7, the lame man said, I have no one, when he's starting off his answers. You know, it's not really true. The only person he really needed was standing right in front of him. The only person he needed was Jesus. And Jesus was there. It wasn't true that he had no one. So don't be like the lame man. Don't be blinded by your pride. Don't be blinded by your insufficiency. Because there's another option. Because you can turn to Jesus. So that's what it looks like to rest in your inability. To be content in your situation. To not have any hope. But on the flip side, it's also possible to rest in your ability, in the way that you can do things. For example, think about, why does the Sabbath exist? Why did God give the people the Sabbath? There's a number of different ways you could answer that question. I don't like the way John Piper answered it. He said about Jesus' words here, what's he saying? I think something like this. My Father and I created a perfect world, a paradise, and then we rested. Not that we were tired, but stepped back, as it were, and enjoyed the perfect display of our own glory revealed in our creative handiwork. That's what the Sabbath is for, the restful, focused enjoyment of God. And I think he's onto something there. The Sabbath wasn't just about taking a nap. It wasn't about sleeping 10 hours versus 8 hours. The Sabbath was intended to make the people stop from their lives and think about, why am I here? Why do I have life? Who is God and why should I serve him? That's what the Sabbath was intended for. Now, here's the strange thing. the Pharisees turned the Sabbath essentially into an instrument of torture. They took this good thing and twisted it beyond recognition. So, what kind of rules did they put around the Sabbath? What kind of restrictions did they put? Well, there's a couple, according to Tim Keller. One, you couldn't carry anything on the Sabbath. This is why the lame man got the attention of the Pharisees, because he wasn't supposed to be carrying his mat. But here's the catch. According to Pharisaical law, you could wear things on the Sabbath. So if the man had wrapped the mat around him and worn it, it would have been all fine, according to their regulations. That's not the only thing. You also couldn't do medical work on the Sabbath. Now, one way that you would treat toothaches, for example, back in these times, was to put vinegar on your tooth. There's a problem, according to the Pharisees. That's medical work. But there's a good thing. There's a loophole. If you have a toothache, you can put just enough vinegar on your food so that as you eat your food, you can get the vinegar on your tooth, and it fixes your tooth. That's not considered to be work, according to the Pharisaical law. This sounds kind of confusing. Yeah, kind of is. There's another rule. According to the Pharisees, you're not allowed to travel on the Sabbath. Well, this raises an interesting question. What's considered travel away from your home? And the way that they defined it in their rules was travel is anywhere over 1,000 yards from your home. So as long as you walk less than 1,000 yards from your home, then everything's fine. This raises another question. What's your home? How do you define that? And eventually the Pharisees decided, well, if you put enough food for a meal on the Friday before the Sabbath in a building, then you can consider that to be a home, essentially establish a residence somewhere else. So you can start at your original home, you can walk about 1,000 yards to this new home, and then if you have a second place, you can go another 1,000 yards beyond that and basically leapfrog your way across town. Okay, why does this happen? None of this, by the way, is in the Bible. The part about having a home and leapfrogging 1,000 yards across town, that's not in the Bible. I think you know that. So why did the Pharisees create these regulations? Why did they create this religious law around what God had already given them? And I don't know exactly why, but I'll give you one possible reason. It makes it easy to rest in your performance. It makes it easy for you to rest in your performance of the law. Because if someone asks you, hey, did you keep the Sabbath this week? You can say, yes, there are 57 regulations about keeping the Sabbath, and I kept every single one of them. See, your answer can be all about the regulation and whether you checked the box. And on the flip side, you can totally avoid talking about your heart. You can totally avoid talking about what you believe. You can totally avoid talking about what's most important to you. This creates an easy system for you to rest in your performance of the law without actually talking about your heart. That's one possible answer. So what are the results of this system? If this is the way you treat the Sabbath, or if this is the way you treat God's law, what happens? What are the results? I think there's three main things. One, reliance on your own ability produces a deep insecurity. Produces deep insecurity. And that's exactly what you see from the Pharisee leaders here. Notice they had already asked him, who is this man at the beginning of the story? The man says, I don't know who it was. And then the Pharisees don't let it go. Verse 12, they actually go and try to track him down. They want to figure out who is this man. To me, this signals the Pharisees are deeply insecure. They're the most powerful religious leaders in the land at that day, but they don't have that security within themselves. They're deeply insecure. And they're threatened by people who do it better than them, who keep the law better or seem to have a purer heart. They're threatened by people who do good. They're threatened by people who don't need their regulations. For example, Jesus showing here he didn't need their rules. They're threatened by people who don't follow their laws. And then three, they're threatened by good itself. Let's not lose track of what's actually happening here. Jesus is doing a good work. He's healed this man who's been laying there for 40 years. And the Pharisees feel threatened by it. It's possible to have your heart so hardened by evil, even if you're a religious person, that you can feel threatened by good itself. That's what you see from the Pharisees here. And again, these are not the town atheists. These are not the agnostics. These are the religious people, the church-going people who teach Sunday school every day. These are the people who are threatened by good. And if that's not a warning to us, I'm not sure what could be. Beyond that, what else do we see in the Pharisees here who rest in their performance of the law? Well, two, it produces irrationality. You know, one of my favorite parts of this story is the man, after he's healed, he walks over to the Pharisees. And no one apparently thinks this is strange. As far as we know, nobody comments on this, like, how did you get here? Nobody says that. So then, it's almost like God says, well, in case y'all missed that the first time, I'm going to run this by you a second time. So the lame man comes back in verse 15, and again he walks up to them to tell them, it was Jesus who made me well. Again, nobody stops to think, oh, how did you get here? So usually I would stop here to ask why. I really don't have a good answer for you, except to say this. Sin produces a deep irrationality. Not only about spiritual truths, just about truth in general. You didn't have to totally be on board with who Jesus claimed to be back in the first century to be able to see, this man's been on the floor for 40 years, now he's upright. How did this happen? You didn't have to be a believer just to notice that simple truth. So we can see from this that sin produces irrationality. It's deeply illogical and can blind you to even the most simple truths. A.W. Tozer once said, a heart set on unbelief will not believe no matter how much evidence is presented. And there are people all around the world today who say, if I could just see a miracle, then I would believe in God. If I could just see the Lord walking among us, then I would believe. If I could just see some great sign, that would be enough for me. And here's the thing. There were plenty of people in the first century who saw a miracle and didn't believe. There were plenty of people in the first century who saw lots of miracles and didn't believe. There were people who saw lots of miracles and not just didn't believe, but they hated Jesus for it. So if you want enough evidence to believe, you already have it. If you want to read the Bible, if you want to read the inspired word, you have all the evidence you need, and you don't need God to come back today and do a miracle just for you. So that's a lesson we can see here. Don't be deeply irrational like the Pharisees were. What's the third thing it produces? It produces an illusion of false growth. When you rest in your own ability, it produces an illusion of spiritual growth. And I think maybe the best passage to talk about spiritual growth is Galatians 5, when Paul talks about the fruit of the Spirit. I'm sure you know the verse. Paul says, the fruit of the Spirit is love, joy, peace, forbearance, kindness, goodness, faithfulness, gentleness, and self-control. Against such things there is no law. And notice about that passage. The word fruit is singular. It's not the fruits of the Spirit. He lists all kinds of qualities, love, joy, peace. But it's not 9, 7, or 8 fruits. It's one fruit. Okay, so why does that matter? Are we just getting into semantics at this point? Well, no. It's deeply, deeply important. And here's why. This is what sets Christians apart. When you have all of these qualities growing together. This is how you know the work of the Spirit. When you see all the qualities growing in tandem. Now, there are plenty of people in the world who don't care at all about Jesus, but they have some of these qualities. I'm sure in your life you know people who are kind, and you know people who are loyal, and you know people who have love. And this is, I think, what you see in the Pharisees. I think the Pharisees had a good degree of inner peace. I think they were pretty confident in what they believed. I think they were secure in what they thought. I think they knew what they thought God told them to do. I think they had a degree of inner peace. And yet they don't have love. Yet they don't have joy. And you can see the same thing with other qualities of the fruit of the Spirit. For example, you probably know people who are unbelievably kind, but they have no self-control. They're unbelievably nice. Even if they're not a Christian, they're just naturally a sweetheart. And yet, they have no self-control. When they find something they want, they'll just buy it. They find a guy or a girl they want, they just go after them. There's no self-control. It's the same thing with other qualities. For example, if you're going to have forbearance, there are plenty of people who are patient, but people who don't have joy. I mean, you can do this with any of the qualities of the fruit of the Spirit. What sets Christian growth apart is that you have all these qualities growing together. That's the key to it here. And if you're resting in your own ability, if you're like the Pharisees here, then it may look like you're growing spiritually. Again, Pharisees are the most popular or the most prominent religious leaders of the day. I'm sure it looked like they had spiritual growth. But that's the thing. If you rest in your own ability, that growth can be an illusion. So what's the answer here? We've talked about resting in your own inability. We've talked about people who rest in ability. So what's the answer here? Well, Jesus offers it to us right here in John chapter 5. I'll say, first of all, it's not in anything physical. This should be obvious to us, but rest does not come to us physically, not ultimate rest. Ultimate rest doesn't come physically. I mean, if you ever slept for a long time, had a good night's rest for 10 or 12 hours, and then you wake up in the morning and you're just exhausted. Have you ever felt that way? Or have you ever gone on vacation, like headed out on a Monday, drove down to the beach, did your thing, whatever you do at the beach, for a week, and then Saturday night or Sunday night you drive back and you've got work on Monday morning and you think to yourself, I am just exhausted. Have you ever felt that way? Or have you ever taken a nap, and when you wake up from the nap, you think, I feel like a truck just hit me. Have you ever felt that way? I mean, I have. So, all those things are good, but it's not where you find ultimate rest. And I'd like to think that God designed it that way, to show you that this is just a temporary measure of rest. This is just a taste of the eternal rest that I have waiting for you. You were never meant to be satisfied in this temporary rest. I mean, have you ever thought about why sleep exists? It's kind of a funny question, but I mean, God could have made us where we just walk around 24 hours a day, right? Why did God make sleep in the first place? Why did he make rest? The Bible doesn't say exactly, but one thing that sleep does is it forces you to stop. The most powerful people in the world, the most famous celebrities, the greatest rock stars all have to lie flat on their back motionless for 8 hours every day. And while that happens, the world is still spinning. So God is showing you the world's not all about you. This world is not all there is. You are not all there is. So when you find rest, use that as a way to point you back to Jesus, to point you back to the ultimate, lasting, eternal rest that he offers you. That's how you should look at gifts like rest. And hey, I like vacation, and I like going to the beach, and I like taking a nap. Every Sunday afternoon, I take a nap, and it's one of the best parts of my week. But that's not where you're going to find lasting rest. So why Jesus? If it's not in anything else, why is Jesus the answer? There are several things that you could say here. I'll just give you one thing. Look at what Jesus' enemies said. Look at the words of the people who hated Jesus. Verse 18, it says, therefore the Jews sought to kill him. Why? Not only because he broke the Sabbath, that's really a side point. That's not their real concern here. The Jews sought to kill Jesus, verse 18, because he said that God was his Father, making himself equal with God. Now, there's this popular philosophy running around today that Jesus never claimed to be God, never wanted to be called God. Jesus was just a good man and a good teacher with some good teachings. Here's the thing. That's not what people in the first century heard Jesus say. That's not what they heard. Even people who hated Jesus, that's not what they heard. Why do you think Jesus got killed? It's not because he had a new self-help book. It's because he said, I am God. So you don't have to come to the same conclusions as the Pharisees. You can come to a different conclusion. But regardless, it should catch your attention. People who hated Jesus, people who killed Jesus, heard him say, "I am the Son of God." So the question is, what are you going to do with that? What are you going to do with that? Because ultimately, we're just like the lame man, right? We have to make our choice about what we're going to do with Jesus. And if you're crippled by your inability, if you feel like you don't measure up, if you're like the lame man and you think all your hope has been lost, just like the lame man, you can still run to Jesus. And if you're crippled by your ability, if you're crippled by your pride and thinking that you have it all figured out and you have to get to Jesus or get to God all by yourself, then you can do the exact same thing that the Pharisees could have done and should have done. You can run to Jesus. That's the offer that Jesus makes to every one of us. So here's the point. Don't rest in anything else. Don't rest in anyone else. But you can rest in the one who made rest. That's where you can find your peace. That's where you can find your comfort. And that's where you can find your joy. So before we close, let's pray together. Father, thank you for creating us. Thank you for loving us. Thank you for calling us to yourself. Thank you for showing us that the rest of this world is not all there is. Thank you that you give us an eternal home, an eternal rest. Thank you for eternal peace. So as we walk this earth, help us to remember that rest is found only in you. And help us to remember this for our good and for your glory. Amen.